Blog Talk Radio.
Don Show. My name is Don Allen in Studio A, and over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how's it going on this kind of misty, foggy, frozen night?
Yes. Well, it's not the traditional January here in the Twin Cities, but, appreciate and be blessed with what we've got. A year ago today, it was 9 below zero, wind chill of about 28, 29 below zero. Been below zero for about 12 days, so
I remember.
We should be just happy with what it is that that we have. Don, I understand we have another hard-hitting program tonight.
Yes, sir.
We're going
yes, sir.
All across basically the country. We're starting in Cincinnati, I understand, this evening.
Yes, we are. We are starting in Cincinnati with some challenges there with the NAACP branch in Cincinnati. And joining us tonight is Mr. Jim Klingman, former president, head of the economic committee for the NAACP in Cincinnati. And you know, last week, Mr. Edwards, we had on Classy Dudley and her father, Harrison Dudley, from Duluth, with the troubles and the challenges that they're going through up in Duluth, Minnesota. And now I stumbled upon this website, this news and information website authored by Mr. Klingman. And I said, wow, this looks like stuff that everyone's going through in the country. So without further ado, welcome Mr. Klingman to the Ron and Don Show. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Ron, and thank you, Don. Good to be with you tonight.
Yeah, our pleasure, sir. Yeah. My colleague, Mr. Allen, Don Allen, will start it out with you. He's had some conversation, prior conversation. I'll just kind of segue in. Mr. Allen, go right ahead.
Yes, first thing, I intercepted some emails here and some court filings from Hamilton County, Ohio, Mr. Klingman, and it says they verified complaint for temporary restraining order, preliminary injunction. This was actually the complaint, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that the Cincinnati branch of the NAACP filed against the director of branches, Mr. Reverend Gail Ford, and the headquarters of the NAACP, correct?
Yes, it was filed against Ford and the supervisory committee, the election supervisory committee.
Okay, that's going to be Richard Richardson, Jonathan White, Sheila Colvin, Marjorie Mosley, Penny Worsham, and Susan Johnson, then, correct?
That's right.
Okay, what led to this filing by the branch members in Cincinnati?
Well, it would take a couple of our shows to lay it all out, but I'll see if I can capitalize it.
That's all right. We're going an hour and a half tonight. Go right ahead, Mr. Kramer.
Well, I can go back and recap some history for you, but what led up to this was just a matter of the members of the local branch of the organization just having had enough of Gil Ford and his shenanigans. We've been going around with him for two elections. He interceded on the one in 2012, and, of course, he interceded on this latest one that was supposed to happen in November of 2014. And, you know, the members of the branch, the executive committee, the new president, they tried to work things out, you know, quietly and do things decent and in order, as the saying goes. But they were running up against brick walls with Gil Ford, because what he was essentially doing, and we have documentation to show this, he was collaborating with the side that he wanted to be in control of the branch.
And what would be his motive, sir? What was the motive for wanting to control the certainly the direction and the mission of the Cincinnati NAACP?
Well, I have my thoughts on it, my opinion about it. I can't prove it. I really don't know factually.
Okay.
But, you know, I would suggest that because they're backed by a union, and I know the NAACP is very close to unions. I saw that when I went to the national conference in Orlando. And because I think the former president, who is now a Cincinnati city councilman, a very strong, young, intelligent, honest black man who ran the NAACP for 7 years before he resigned, Christopher Smitherman is his name.
Mr. Smitherman, Gil Ford,
I believe, did not like Christopher, because Christopher would not kowtow to him. We did everything right. We did everything according to the rules. We sent them untold sums of money because we raised the membership from about 400 to over 2,000. And raised money. You know, we did very well with the Freedom Fund dinner and everything. I mean, the National gave us 4 awards in 2013, and the year before that, they gave us the Tallheimer. So we got it twice. Back to back for all the things we have been doing in the community. But yet, we never got any support or assistance from Gil Ford when we called or wrote to him about the shenanigans that were going on by the folks who were trying to take it over, the union folks. We never got any positive response from him. Every time he called or wrote to us, it was something negative. So I'm thinking that he wanted those folks in because he knew he probably could control them. They probably would do everything he wanted them to do. Christopher Smitherman was not like that, and I was certainly not the one that would go along with that kind of stuff. So the executive committee this year decided, we have to stop this. So they filed for a temporary restraining order after Ford wrote several letters saying that we're going to suspend the election. I know you know the drill.
Yes.
Yeah, he just, kept writing all this negative stuff, kept talking to the other side without talking to the current president, whose name is Eastern Morton, and got to the point where it was so obviously one-sided and biased that the executive committee said, we're going to file a lawsuit against this guy because he's really collaborating and doing some things that really fly in the face of what the National NAACP is supposed to stand for and to stand against, and that's voter suppression, which Ford tried to do by changing the venue at the request of the head of the supervisory committee, who is the son of the candidate for president.
Okay.
Now, let me slow down and say that again. You got that, right? He was
son. We know that.
Candidate for president, and he was not elected, he was appointed by this equally crooked state president, state of Ohio, who lost an election. Ford comes in, has another election. From what I told, he let children vote. She won then, so she's still the state president. So she comes in.
And she is located where? Cleveland, Columbus, where?
In Columbus.
In Columbus, right, okay.
Yeah. So she comes in or sends her rep in to the membership meeting and selects. After the voting took place at their first meeting, I think that she or her representative selected this guy who's the son of the president who's running against the incumbent president. And he works for the union, okay? And another guy on the supervisory committee is currently under investigation by the state of Ohio Elections Commission for election fraud.
And guess who
that was against? Former president, Christopher Smitherman, who is a Cincinnati city councilman. You connect all those dots. So that was one of the things, changing the venue. No reason for it. We're just going to change it. And guess where they wanted to change it to? The union hall.
The candidate's union hall, okay? Are you at liberty to indicate what international union this is, or
I'm at liberty to say whatever I want to say because I'm telling the truth.
Go ahead.
It's local 265 laborers union. And the guy that's over it, his name is Robert Richardson Sr. His son works for him as an attorney, and his son presided over the supervisory committee. So all of those things were connected. It changed that. They tried to change the venue. Ford said, yeah, we're going to change the venue. Ford also changed the day of the election from a Tuesday, on which has been held for years, for decades, from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. He changed it to a Saturday, at first from 11 to 4. And then I guess he got a little pressure and changed it and made it 8 hours instead of 5 hours. But we've been having our election for 12 hours. We had over 2,000 members.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to change the day, change the venue, change the hours, is voter suppression.
Yeah.
And on top of that, he wrote a letter the day before our election, which was supposed to have been after he came in and changed it, on the 13th, I think it was the 13th of December. He writes a letter dated December the 12th, and suspending the current president, which in essence would have given the opposite guy, his guy, the election by default by simply casting one vote for him. Because
the
suspended guy wouldn't be eligible to run.
Right.
Ford did all of this stuff. And fortunately, the judge saw it our way. And it's plain to see. I mean, I haven't even given you all of the things. But
it's plain
to see. And the judge said, no, you got to stop this. And it was issued, the TRO was issued. They had a hearing, I think, on the 15th. Of December 18th, something like that. I'm not sure about all the dates. And the judge said there will not be an election until I say there will be an election. So I'm thinking now that we probably won't have one until March, but we're pushing for a disinterested, objective party to preside over the election and not deal forward.
Right. Now, has Mr. Ford, or excuse me, Reverend Ford, I want to be respectful.
Well,
has
I
Reverend
call him
Ford,
Mr. Ford.
Well, as Reverend Ford,
I don't even call him Mister. I call him Gil Ford.
Gil Ford, has he threatened to suspend the branch and all those of you as an outgrowth of that you sought and were involved in litigation? Because 12 years ago, that's a tactic he pulled up here, as he removed a number of members. And, in fact, yours truly. I mean, I always want to be transparent. In fact, I was probably only the fifth person in about 70 years that had been actually expelled from the NAACP because I had raised the question about the disappearance of over $1 million from the Leave No Child Left Behind program that we had here, that when they got through with it, Ford and them had put together a group of African-Americans or Negroes here who – all of a sudden had control of the program without any formal vote or et cetera on the part of the branch. Next thing you know, the branch was stripped. There was a very popular minister who has left the ministry now. In fact, he resides in Tampa, Florida. He also was the chaplain of the Minnesota legislature. He left out of here with enough money to build a couple new houses in Tampa. But the money was gone. In fact, the then national president, Kwasi Amfumi, was involved with that. So, see, Mr. Allen, I have a deep appreciation of the original statement made about corruption all the way up into the national office. We saw it in living color here. But go ahead, sir.
I've gotten calls from several branches around the country since I wrote those two articles from Colorado Springs, talking about some money missing and Gil Ford involved, from Philadelphia, the same thing, some money issues and mismanagement. And to answer your question, yes, he threatened to suspend all of the memberships of the members of the executive committee who filed the suit. That hasn't been done, but that was a threat. But I think
now that's the same tactic.
We hauled them into court, they changed their mind about that.
Okay. Similar pattern happened here. But what happened, the branch of the dissidents, as we would call ourselves, did not have strong enough attorneys, per se. And actually, they got to the attorneys. Of course, there was enough money to do that. In fact, they actually brought in a member from, because in your region is also the state of Michigan, right?
Yes.
Yeah. They brought in a gentleman. I don't know if he's still alive or not. They brought him in. A couple of young women took care of him, including a woman that later would become the wife of Gail Ford. Oops. Mm. She at that time was the president of the Minneapolis branch. By the time they, like I said, the time they all got through with us, the program was gone. The money was the money was
wow.
gone. People were moving to luxurious tropical.
Man,
etc. So, sir, this pattern in practice, and by the way, you mentioned Colorado Springs. You know, Gail Ford got his start right up the road there in Denver, where he was married to a very popular.
I've had a call from Denver, too. Yeah.
Oh, man, they hate him there. He was married to a very
that.
Popular black educator. She was a principal there at one of the schools. He so disrespected his marriage to her that ultimately they divorced. But his reputation became so tainted in Denver, and the records will show this, what we're talking about here on this program, that the national was required and forced to move the regional office from Denver to St. Louis for a period of time.
Wow.
Where it still is. And and next thing we knew, our president was gone. Ford got a divorce. His wife filed for divorce. They came together, ultimately got married, and then within a year and a half, he was rewarded and brought to Baltimore to begin to become the master of, quote-unquote, the branches of the NAACP, in other words, director of branches. This man has a tremendous history. You know, he originally started out, Gail, I hope you're listening, buddy. You know, he originally started out before he became an NAACP administrator, et cetera. He was a bus driver for the Denver Metropolitan Transit Company. Mr. Allen, did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yeah, he was a bus driver. And this very lovely, professional African-American woman took him, married him, educated him, helped him get his credentials, and that was her reward, if you will. I mean, this man has a very interesting history, and it's been like that for over 15 years, and there are many in the corporate offices, national offices of the NAACP, both in Baltimore and whatever office they have left up in New York City as it pertains to the national, who know this history. And there are members of the national board that know this history. And so I concur with you, sir, that some of these folks are driven, quote unquote, by corruption and profit. No doubt about
it. Yeah, and that was one of the reasons I was going to give you too for how, you know, why he's doing what he's doing. I think I really believe there's some money behind this. And I also believe, since he's been around so long and has such a terrible record among so many branches, he must have something on or must be doing something with some of these national folks to the point that they would protect him and not come down on him for all the stuff he's been doing. And this is not something people are making up. This is not something, and I, for one, am not a person who is angry at the NAACP and I'm going to get them and all that. I worked for the NAACP. I worked my behind off for the NAACP as a volunteer for 8 years. So It wasn't like, well, I'm going
to
go and get them.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, it's like he has something. If he's been around that long, and I didn't know that.
Oh, yes.
He must have something
long
with these national folks who will not do anything, because I've called several people, his bosses. I've even put in calls to the top echelon of NAACP about this guy. I've sent letters long before all this stuff came out. I tried to do it the right way. They never responded to me except by saying thank you for your note.
Now
that was it.
For my colleague, Mr. Allen, that sounds so familiar because that's the same modus operandi 13, 12, 13. And 11 years ago, same modus operandi.
Wow.
The cast of characters, the national board members back in those days, some are still there. Some have been there so long that you think that they are in a parallel universe. That's the way they would handle you. We brought some of them into court. We were able initially to subpoena some, but once they got to the attorneys that were representing the dissidents, And I want to be respectful because at least one of the individuals who really fought a tenacious fight is deceased. She died about 7 years ago. There were others that just left this town. I mean, they got the heck out of here. They just said, it's really
well,
too much. Yeah, go ahead,
sir. I think that that's what they thrive on. They thrive and rely on the history of people just backing down from them and people not following through. And that's why I so adamantly suggested that the executive committee, I'm not on it anymore, but I said, you got to take this guy to court. You got to be prepared for the long haul. You got the money. I mean, we did
very well.
Let me
share this with you so that, because you are absolutely on point, because this is all about the history of this man. There is a woman by the name of Carol Ann White. Miss White was a longtime resident of Minneapolis. In fact, she was an elected public official. She was elected to the Minneapolis School Board in the very early 2000s. She was a part of the group of dissidents that filed suit against Gail Ford and Kwasi Nfumi and others. What ultimately happened, she just decided she no longer wanted to live here. She moved to Blytheville, Arkansas. And actually, they had a very strong NAACP branch in Blytheville, and they really have a strong NAACP base in eastern Arkansas, okay, from down there from the boot of Missouri down to West Memphis. And she filed a complaint 2008, and she demanded a hearing. They tricked her. They brought her to Baltimore for what she thought was going to be a hearing, and she was arrested.
Wow.
Her name is Carol Ann White. She resides now in Blytheville, Arkansas, if you will. I think she's still somewhat involved. The Blytheville NAACP has filed numerous complaints against Gail Ford. But after Carol Ann White was arrested by Baltimore County Police outside of the NAACP headquarters in Baltimore, folks got real nervous. And then they found out that there were a couple of operatives. Gail Ford was paying, providing remuneration to a couple of individuals who were sabotaging the dissident groups there, and et cetera. I don't know what the status is now. I haven't really talked to folks down there in the last couple of years. Miss White is still in Blytheville, but I repeat again, they told her to come to Baltimore for a hearing.
Well, that's the way, you know, when our current president was issued his infamous letter of suspension, he requested a hearing as well, but he did it through his attorney, and he said, "I want this hearing to be by teleconference."
Oh, that was a good move, and
we
you don't go up there
in the lion's den and expect to
win.
Because you know they're crooked from the start.
Oh yeah, and have strong ties because of the relationship of Nfumi at that time, and still as a former congressman in Baltimore. And then, you know, later as president of the NAACP. But I tell you, many folks were shocked in the matter of Carol Ann White of Blytheville, Arkansas. So I've laid that out. Anybody want to challenge it? It's all in the records.
Well, you know, I think that because of all of the branches that have called me, and you probably know, I heard you on the radio, what was it, last week or week before, when you listed or somebody listed, it sounded like 15 or 20 different
that
branches.
That was Mr. Dudley out of Duluth with an 11-page document. Yes,
yeah,
that was Mr. Dudley out of Duluth. Yes.
It just went on and on and on, and it boggles my mind why local branches have not and will not form a coalition to come against this stuff, because that's where the work is done, number one. And the branches, from my experience, branches don't get anything from the national. I mean, our little $30 it ought to get us a discount at a hotel or something like AAA. They got so many.
Well, not after what happened in Houston.
Well, I don't know about all that, but I'm saying we didn't get anything from the national. We just
in the case of Houston, there was significant theft. What happened there, though, they made a mistake. The woman who was the treasurer of the Houston NAACP was also an attorney. It is on file there in Houston. The lawsuit brought by her and others are dissidents in the NAACP with regards to hotel bills and et cetera that the NAACP ran out on, and Gail Ford, you know, served as the instrument to block that too, to block an investigation and a corrective action. That case is now pending in Houston, Texas.
Well, I'm my eyes are being opened every day when people call me, and then talking to you guys with all the history you have about this, because it just amazes me that something hasn't been done before now. But again, a lot of the branches are small. They don't have any money because they're giving 6% of it to the national and get nothing in return, and they feel helpless and weak and isolated. That's why branches need to work together. There's nothing stopping branches from talking and forming their own independent coalition to come at these kinds of problems in a collective way. But if you feel like you're out there by yourself, you're either going to get scared off or they're going to pick you off because they have deeper pockets than you do. So it's really incumbent upon the branches to build up some kind of cash and to be good stewards of that money like we were. And so that if a fight does come, we can stand up and fight, because it makes no sense to even have an NAACP comprised of all these local branches if the branches, first of all, have no power. No power. Everything is arbitrarily exercised over them by the national, and they have no recourse when something negative goes down. It makes no sense to even have one, because all we're doing is providing the money to the national to have an image award and a national convention.
And by the way, on the thing with the Image Award, I think we'd be remiss if we did not indicate the fate of Reverend Pinckney in Benton Harbor, Michigan, was on this program, who began serving a prison's term as an outgrowth of a heck of a conspiracy against him when he raised certain questions about arrangements between a major corporation in Benton Harbor, Muskegon, and the national NAACP.
Yeah, it was Whirlpool.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Whirlpool. Yeah,
a guy called me about that too. When was that? Day before yesterday. Of course, I've been following the Pinckney issue off and on for years. But you know, he called me and told me about it. He said, "Well, he's going to prison, December 15th, I think he went in
for voter fraud, right?"
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's what's so ironic and hypocritical about what's going on, especially in Cincinnati. You have the national office fighting against taking away voting rights, fighting against voter suppression, fighting against venue changes, and yet they allow that to happen within their own ranks on the local level. And they participate in it by, you know, through Ford. He actually participated in voter suppression.
Yes, he has.
And denying members their votes by changing everything, confusing everybody. I mean, how can they stand by and allow that?
And they do, and it's for our listening audience, both domestically and internationally. This is not something that just started in the last 10 weeks or 10 months. This has been going on for at least 14 years.
Wow. So we're new to the game.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Allen, do you have any additional questions of our guests? Because we've got a couple other hot items and et cetera. And we hope, by the way, sir, that this helps our friends in Duluth to get a better understanding and be an eye-opener, because Duluth is a city of about 92,000, probably about 3,000 African-Americans, former military base, so a lot of folks retired and stayed up there. It's up in northern Minnesota.
Yeah.
We're trying to put some things together. President up there is the American version of Papa Doc or Duvalier. He's been president up there for 30 years.
For life. President for life.
President.
Yeah.
They defeated him. Gail Ford used the state conference president here, who is also the president of the Rochester, Minnesota NAACP, brought him up there and just walked into the room and told him that the election was null and void and that Claudel Washington was the ongoing president. They had a vote. The next meeting, 18 people showed up. By the way, the branch did not have for a number of years the required 50 members in good standing. You know, you got to have that in order to be an ongoing branch. And Claudia used to have basically about 28, 29 people. He also was the city's purchasing director for the city of Duluth.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, black folk never did get no contracts, man. But anyways, the history is just important. Let me say this in closing with you, sir, is that it's probably going to take a coup d'etat at the National Convention on the convention floor. And
that's
that means, of course, dealing with the Rules Committee specifically and et cetera. I saw this happen in 1996. Almost was pulled off, but the again, like you said, pockets too deep and too many smaller branches terrified of offending, quote-unquote, Big Daddy.
Yeah. Well, we have a president of the local branch who's been involved with the NAACP for over 30 years. He and his specialty is at bylaws and constitution and going to these national conferences and bringing resolutions, writing them and all that. So he knows his way around to do that. The issue is that we need to before it goes to Philadelphia, and that's what the brother called me the next time, and they got the nerve to come to Philadelphia, where they just as crooked as a day is long.
I
said, yeah, they're coming to Cincinnati the year after. So now is the time to start rallying people.
Wow.
Yeah, Cincinnati 216. And that's another reason I think he wanted to get the union guys in charge, because, you know, presidential election, all that kind of stuff.
You're absolutely correct. And then you'll get big money
now
from corporate Cincinnati, particularly from Procter & Gamble and et cetera.
Oh, yes. Because, you know, we held it in 2008 under Christopher Smitherman, and it was one of the best conferences ever in the NAACP. We raised a lot of money. We got black people for the first time to be vendors inside of the convention center. That had never happened before in Cincinnati until we brought the NAACP there. You know, Obama came and some other folks. It was a real big deal. So now they were.
I remember following it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we had the same thing here in 1972 with the NAACP. That's a story within itself. But
well,
appreciate
I
it. Feel free to give Mr. Allen and myself a call and update us if you would.
Well, here's what
you
I
know,
want to
the
say
nation needs to know that there's just significant problems inside the NAACP
national.
That's
exactly right. And here's what I want to leave with. I know a lot of people are listening. If you're out there at a branch, you need to get in touch with the Cincinnati branch. Let's form this coalition. Let's start working on these resolutions and have this coup d'etat at the national. I'm sure some of the national people are listening. I don't care about
certainly.
That. But
certainly.
We have to do what we have to do. Otherwise, what's the point in being involved at all?
Oh, by the way, on that particular note, again, you're on point because President Brock has relatives in this city, and in fact, I knew her uncle. She's probably just realizing who I really am. But I knew her uncle. But Miss Brock has been here on a number of occasions. People tried to reach out to her, but she was not accommodating, if you will. So there's a lot of history here, sir. So could you give us a number, a fax or something that people can get in touch with you in Cincinnati?
Yeah, my number is 513-315-9866.
Could you repeat that one more time?
513-315-9866. And the number to our local office is 513-281-1900.
All right.
513-281-1900.
All right. We appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Mr. Allen, don't you think we expect to talk back with our Cincinnati colleagues probably in a couple of weeks?
Oh, absolutely. We're going to keep in touch.
We'll keep you informed.
I send the email almost every day, so we can keep in touch. So,
all right.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, sir. We appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
And the best to you. All right. All right.
Same to you.
Wow, I tell you. No wonder the membership of the NAACP has just been declining and declining and declining over the last 12, 13, 14, 15 years. It wasn't for the Image Award and Reverend Pinckney, who is now serving time for, and we didn't really elaborate because we were pressing. The NAACP was able to get to the local sheriff there in Benton Harbor and Muskegon, and the sheriff and them ran kind of what they said was a sting operation. When they got through with it, they had Reverend Pinckney, one of the most respected civil rights activists in Western Michigan indicted. See, that's how they really got him, Don. They indicted him. They had somebody come in. A couple of cats came in, maintained that they were paid to go vote. And we just found out from our Cincinnati friend that Reverend Pinckney was convicted, if you will, by, I understand it was an all-white jury there in Benton Harbor, and began his prison term this past December. In fact, it's the talk of Western Michigan about the demise and undermining of Reverend Pinckney, one of the most respected NAACP leaders, who we were honored to have on this program at least five times, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Maybe, Don, we should pull up on demand a couple of those programs and let people hear Reverend Pinckney, because Reverend Pinckney sounded just like our colleague there in Cincinnati. And the National will come and get you know, in order to further corruption.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, you had mentioned the Image Awards. And
yes,
it's too bad with all this chaos, the NAACP couldn't give their own self an Image Award. You know?
Absolutely. And keep in mind that Reverend Pinckney was the man who 2 years ago demonstrated outside of the theater there in Los Angeles, which enraged some of the leadership of the NAACP, and that's when the plan was put into play, operating and cooperating with white law enforcement officers in Western Michigan. And the bottom line was Reverend Pinckney was indicted, charged with voter fraud in a county election, and convicted by an all-white jury, as I understand it. So,
yep.
Well, Don, we've got... You know, we've got a situation here at one of our local schools that, man, it looks like though there may be very well be a brown and black coalition being formed. A woman by the name of Cruz,
okay.
Lorraine Cruz, who was brought here, actually recruited by the Minneapolis Public School District from Chicago, where she had an 18-year career, as I understand it from the information being placed on the Star Tribune's website, brought here 2 years ago to fresh start, really. That's really what it was, to fresh start Green Central. Green, by the way, is named for the first African-American superintendent in the history of Minneapolis. She came in. She transferred 43 white employees, the majority of them teachers, but others, the maintenance personnel, office administrators, and et cetera. I don't think she realized the kind of enemies that she was making, though she was being told by both white and black administrators, Mr. Allen, at the district headquarters there at 1250 West Broadway, that they were happy with what she was doing. They weren't, if you will. And this past Sunday, according to sources that had been identified in a series of news articles by the Star Tribune, she was informed by text message that she was not to come on to the... Now, this woman is a principal, okay? 18-year veteran administrator recruited and given a 3-year contract, Mr. Allen, to come here and to save Green Central, which is a K through eight school in South Central Minneapolis, 3-year contract, okay, and she was told that she was not to talk to any employees of the district other than the associate superintendent who undermined her. She was not to come on the premises and etc. And I'm telling you, the attack that they have leveled against this woman is just unbelievable. By the way, she is of the race. She is a Puerto Rican. As I understand it, born in the Bronx, New York, began her educational career in Chicago, tough school district, has excellent credentials, if you will, was in fact... being courted by even a couple of foreign countries when the offer was made to her, according to the Star Tribune online. But this is the second principle that has been removed because of and is creating or an attempt to create racial tension between blacks and browns, Hispanic Latinos, and African Americans. I'm not sure it's going to happen this time, Mr. Allen, but it is a firestorm. And by the way, we haven't given the phone numbers. The lines on this one, or phone lines, are certainly open. If you
yes,
would,
they are.
Shoot the...
Sure. So that number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. The phone lines are wide open. We have a lot of people in the queue. But, Mr. Edwards, let me see if I understand what you're saying about this.
Yes, sir.
Now, like 2 or 3 years ago, there was problems within Richard Green Central, which was formerly the Minneapolis Central, the school that I graduated from in 1979.
Oh, that's right. You did. You were an alumnus of Central. That's right. That's right, Mr. Allen. Mm-hmm.
Before they tore it down and built a new one, let the neighborhood go to hell, and then they built this new one on it, which is okay. But and when Dr. Green was the superintendent in Minneapolis Public Schools, was the most admired school district in the country, actually. Yes, it was.
He later became chancellor. In other words, superintendent of the New York City Public Schools, where unfortunately he died before his time, if you will, of an asthmatic attack. Anytime you get, you know, a job running the New York public school system, I mean, you got to know what you're doing. I mean, you know, Minneapolis lost a tremendous talent. But go ahead, sir. You had some inquiry.
Yeah, and so, I mean, like a couple of years ago, I'm not sure exactly, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, they were having a problem with the current principal that was at Richard Green Central. And I know that parents got together, and especially one activist, Marianne Robinson, who was very upset with how her kids were being treated there. And I know that principal is gone. And so they bring Ms. Cruz in, and they do.
Under a 3-year contract. 3-year contract.
So anyway, it looks they're going to have to pay her, number one. And number two, they just tell her not to come back, have no
Don, contract. I have to – let me do this because, members of the district's administration have been making late-night calls and et cetera. There have been a number of community activists who have received calls at, like at 10 o'clock at night indicating to them that they need to leave this situation alone, that the district has the evidence. – Now, they started out by implying certain improprieties, maybe sexual in nature, on the part of Ms. Cruz. They've now changed up, I guess, you know, they sit around, they meet with the general counsel, they meet with each other, et cetera. And so then, you know, ultimately the 9, 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock calls. So now they're saying, well, first of all, statement was made last night that really they're doing Ms. Cruz a favor by axing her because there has been, financial and fiscal malfeasance and theft, okay? Now, you understand, this principal, this educator of color has not been presented with any kind of bill of particulars. You know, there's been no charges made against her and et cetera. But the district's agent provocateurs have been, I mean, absolutely at work. I mean, it's just been in the last 72 hours in this city, in the area of educational activities, it's been unbelievable. And both black is being ripped apart by the district. I mean, let me say it like this. A year ago, 7 or 8 white teachers at Green Central, hot about the fact that Ms. Cruz was bringing in persons of color, and she was also developing, because of her own heritage and nationality, a excellent relationship with a very large Latino, Hispanic, in other words, Mexican population was, you know, involved in sending their children to Green Central. They sent a letter to the Commissioner of Education here in the state of Minnesota, who was an African-American woman, a real success story, and they made really some terrible allegations against Ms. Cruz that were just absolutely outrageous. What happened? They got busted, though, Don. Mm. And so the district did not have any choice but to concur with the recommendation of Ms. Cruz, as I understand it from numerous sources, transferred them out. But then at some point, the union and white and black administrators at 1250 West Broadway, and that's the address of the district's beautiful headquarters, built without black labor participation, began to indicate that it was time for Ms. Cruz to go. And just 2 days ago, two members of the Minneapolis Board of Education, one African-American, one white, made the statement that Ms. Cruz, and she does not, she would not be able under Minnesota statute to receive tenure until her third year, in other words, the final year of her contract. Do you know the school board member said that she has no rights because she's not tenured, and so anything that they want to do to her, they can do to her?
Wow.
This is the conversation by two of you board members, if you will, with a couple of community folks. You didn't think that they thought that these folks were hostile or anti-Cruz, if you will. They were not. They were deeply offended by the reflections. Now, these are elected public officials in a state that, you know, we pride ourselves on being liberal here, don't we, Mr. Alvin?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, we are great defenders of, you know, Constitution and et cetera. And so she has been removed. The school district indicated in a copyrighted story again in the Star Tribune that they were already conducting a search. See, when you fire a head administrator in the middle of the school year, I mean, you send all kinds of messages. But at this point, Mr. Allen, everybody's still waiting on the bill of indictment against her. What was it that she did? Now, we're not talking about by inference, innuendo, and et cetera. But what was it that she did? I've talked to a number of people. I've not ever met Ms. Cruz, but I'm hearing excellent things from the African-American community people that I respect. And they tell me of her dedication and commitment to the children of Green Central, okay? And I'm like, okay, I mean, God, this is what the district said apparently when they recruited her, that they wanted her. In fact, we use the term here, as you know, Mr. Allen, fresh start means when you go in and reorganize the entire school. Everybody got to go, okay? And that's what they basically told her, that she had the latitude. She began to do it. And I don't know why they would be surprised, because they knew that one of the issues that had been brought forward by both Latino, Hispanic parents and African-American parents and et cetera, that there were no African-American instructors or anything else in the school.
Oh, my.
And so she began to move to make a racial balance, and she did what she thought, as we understand it. She began to even recruit outside the district, which the district does all the time when they bring in white administrators and et cetera. I mean, we're legendary here in Minneapolis, aren't we, Don?
Going out
and bringing individuals. In fact, we bring individuals in that don't even have a teacher's, don't even have a principal's license. You know, just tell them, come on in, and then we'll get it for you. But anyways, everyone that I'm talking to is indicating that she has done a tremendous job of turning things around at Green Central, that her relationship with the community, particularly the Hispanic Latino community, is extremely solid. I do know that elected Latino Hispanic officials are holding meetings both Thursday and Friday, but the district has warned any employee of the Minneapolis School District who stands up in a meeting and defends Ms. Cruz will be terminated. Now, that sounds like Nazi Germany to me. That doesn't sound like good old, you know, we're, you know, very liberal here in Minnesota. And that's a fact and has been documented by text messages that apparently are being turned over to Mrs. Cruz and her attorneys. I do understand that she has acquired legal counsel.
That she has to, because, you know, under I don't know how much former Superintendent Bernier Johnson has to do with this, or even Gore, but the Minneapolis Public Schools, Mr. Edwards, has always, the administration at least, has always ran and ducked and put their tails between their legs and made a knee-jerk reaction. That ten times out of ten, it's the wrong reaction. But you said something very interesting when you just talked about
how they how you know Ms. Cruz was recruiting, you know, outside of state and recruiting teachers, getting teachers in there. One thing that people should look at, and what our community, because I have this back and forth with this individual on Facebook that has a radio show at this local radio station here, and I don't think she's understanding the point. But the thing is, you go to this Minnesota Board of Teaching. You know, these people are jockeying for all this money, doing this. You go to the Minnesota Board of Teaching, and you sit in one of those meetings, you will immediately understand why there's an education gap, why there are no black male teachers, and why someone like Ms. Cruz, when she starts to make change, it sends ripples from Green Central to the commissioner to the Board of Teaching, and they have to take corrective action because this person is going to be more popular, more powerful than they ever were. And it's unfortunate that they turned the table on her to ask her to leave and not come on the property, but this is the way the people operated. About three Fridays ago, I went and talked to the Board of Teaching. There's two really nice sisters on the board, black women, and I wasn't trying to attack them. But I was talking to the board about the lack of African-American teachers in these schools, in the Minneapolis public schools, because you cannot be what you do not see. And this guy...
Good point, Mr. Allen.
Yeah, this guy cringed. The board of chairman cringed when I said black, African-American, and male.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew right there I had to give up. So I'm just reflecting on Ms. Cruz's situation is that if you try to make changes in Minnesota, not only in the education complex, but out here in the social construct, in corporate America and things like that, and you're a person of color that dots your I's, cross your T's, you become an immediate threat, and all eyes are on you, period.
Well, that apparently is what has happened to Ms. Cruz. Again, we're talking about the ousted principal at Green Central in South Minneapolis, if you will. And the apparent coming together of a black and brown coalition, though the browns, if you will, the Latino, Hispanics, and et cetera, seem to be much more aggressive. Our NAACP and other organizations apparently haven't got, you know, the right signal yet, whatever that's supposed to mean. But I have to tell you, Mr. Allen, what members of the district staff, and I don't think that the superintendent is involved. I do know that one of the signals that was sent in the last 12 or 13 hours is that Acting Superintendent Gore will be at this meeting either Thursday or Friday night, and that he will explain to the people why the principal, Ms. Cruz, has been ousted. Well, maybe he needs to talk to his attorney because she has not been given a bill of particulars. I've talked to a number of supporters during the day today, and they clearly confirm that she is yet to be given a bill of particulars on why she has been relieved of duty. Okay? Now, you do have to remember, even though she may not have tenure, she got a contract.
Yep.
Now, her union representatives, as I understand it, it's ugly. White union representatives told her that she really, you know, may want to move on and that they're not sure that they would be able to defend her position. And I think that according to a couple of sources, it's the reason that she has acquired private counsel, if you will. It is an ugly situation now, right now in South Minneapolis as we speak. And again, these phone lines are open. Anybody out there got any questions? Because people have been on their websites and et cetera for the last 36 hours asking what happened, you know, we're helping to lay it out to you.
Because the article
written by the Minneapolis Star Tribune was weak at best. But, Don, I got to tell you, when you start getting telephone calls at 10 o'clock at night, when community activists who have been long time involved in the educational politics of South Minneapolis start getting calls telling them that, well, you know, we're doing Ms. Cruz a favor, the best that she moves on, you know, she has all kinds of problems and et cetera. And strong supporters of Ms. Cruz are saying, okay, so when did she get the charges, the allegations and et cetera, that allowed the district with comfort to do what they're going to do. Because, by the way, if Ms. Cruz sues and wins, you know, money's not going to come out of her pocket. It's going to come out, oops, the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. People they should be listening to and giving anyway. Yeah, that's very interesting. Very interesting. I don't like to hear when that happens.
No.
Just another setback. The people who suffer the most are the children.
And again, because I asked this question, I said, well, you know, what is her commitment? Does she seem to be committed to the children, or is she just committed to being important or drawing a salary and et cetera? They said, no, brother. It said she is totally committed. I had a long-time educational activist say to me earlier today, you know, made sure that I understood that they had been in the schools, they have watched her administration, they have watched her instructions and et cetera, and it's all about the children. But you and I have talked oftentimes, and Mr. Allen is moving into a direction of educational fulfillment, if you will, just for the record. And these folks just don't care about the survival, the progress, if you will, of the sons and daughters of the African, in other words, the African-American children. I mean, these folks don't care. They tell me that some of the white teachers that had been removed for cause actually had a happy hour on Monday celebrating the dismissal of Ms. Cruz from her position as principal at Central. Now, that's sick. You know what I'm saying? That's absolutely sick. But anyways, that's what's happening. But go ahead, Don, because I want to also report, we are obligated to report on the Department of Justice was in town today.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's go with that. I mean, what was that about, Mr.? I mean, I know that, like, the big shots in town here probably were down at that meeting, some of our communities.
Well, here's what happened. Well, first of all, it goes all the way back to Chief Jhené Harto. And a move she actually made when she first became chief almost 2 years ago, when she asked for help after, you remember, a couple of very high-profile incidences involving Minneapolis police officers and particularly citizens of the communities of color and specifically the African-American community. And the Department of Justice provided a mechanism through a specific office within the Department of Justice that deals with what is called diagnostic examination and et cetera. And so it took them, initially I thought that it was just going to be a game. It took them almost a year. They started in January of 2014 after being asked in, I think it was July of 2013. There was a series of meetings with stakeholders here in Minneapolis. The Department of Justice diagnostic teams then went back to the drawing board. In October of last year, 2014, they returned. There was an update and et cetera. The high-powered players that you just made mention of that I am going to kind of identify never showed up for any of these meetings. They had no interest in really being, you know, a stakeholder, what, you know, I guess that wasn't important enough. Well, there wasn't any money involved, so, you know. But in October, the Department of Justice indicated that they would be making a final recommendation for corrective action. And Minneapolis did something that was rather interesting, and that is that normally jurisdictions, when recommendations are made by the feds, I mean, you know, Ferguson, Missouri is a good example. Cleveland, Ohio is even a better example because they were almost put in receivership. Everything that the diagnostic entity or diagnostic unit of the Department of Justice recommended to the city of Minneapolis, I'll be damned if the city of Minneapolis did not agree to each and every item, which is very unusual. And an assistant United States attorney who came here to, you know, put his blessing on this as well as the diagnostic team and et cetera, indicated that was rare, all right? Well, what happened this afternoon is that veteran law enforcement sources of the Black Association were sharing with me that some of the leaders came in and demanded that they be placed on the committees. There are five committees, and then there is a steering committee, if you will. And the leadership, if you will, a professor at St. Thomas College, if you will, and the head of the NAACP and some others, if you will, some of the same folks have been asking for the $26 million from the governor, demanded that they be placed on the committees. And, I don't know if that's going to happen, but during the course, the following happened. There was present in the room a former African-American police officer by the name of Alicia Clemens, a former sergeant who sued and won against the Minneapolis Police Department over a decade ago, won over $1 million, with the exception of the late Dewey Noe, who was a Asian-American, no officer of color has, you know, ever won that kind of money. Now, five officers won $750,000, but Ms. Clemens won a settlement of $1 million, okay? And I well remember that situation, Mr. Allen, because it goes to what happened earlier today. When Ms. Clemens reached out to the leadership of our community back then, they declined to help her, if you will, just as they did the Mill City Five, the five black police officers who in 2008 won a settlement of $750,000 from the city of Minneapolis for discrimination and et cetera. But in the case of Ms. Clemens, there were some interesting comments directed kind of towards her by some of our leaders that they, the leaders, had brought about change in Minneapolis as it pertains to police community relations. And I was, you know, I'm scratching my head, Don, because I'm trying to figure out what they're talking about, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because I don't remember any of them testifying before the federal grand jury, you know, 15 years ago. I don't remember any of them ever going into court, you know, with lawsuits and et cetera. I don't remember any of them ever being appointed as federal overseers to monitor the police department, et cetera, when we had the PCRC. Most of them would not even come to the meetings, and the ones that were on the committee never showed up. But it got like that today. So what your leaders are now saying is that they are demanding to be put on the on these five committees and the steering committee, which it appears that the chief – now, this is interesting. My sources, professional law enforcement, indicated that the chief didn't back down. She said, you know, you will be given appropriate consideration like anybody else. You know, are there some specific – can you get this, Don? She kind of asked, are there any committees that you think that you may want to be appointed to? Do you know that our leaders couldn't identify the committees Department of Justice had just recommended?
You know what? They're down there, Mr. Edwards, hooping and hollering with hot air and don't know – don't do their homework. It's just like the head of the NAACP going down to the damn stadium and asking them, you got to hire more black people. You got to do this. You got to do that. And the stadium say, well, we hired black people. And they go, oh, okay, and they walk out with any documentation. They have no clue.
You're absolutely correct, sir. Boy, you're absolutely correct on that. Yeah. And by the way, so we're sure we're going to 10 o'clock. Is that right? We're locked in to 10 o'clock?
We're locked and stocked.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Because the phone lines are open as it pertains to all this. I do think that there will be a story in tomorrow morning's edition, maybe online right now of the Star Tribune. But there are five committees, as we said. Then there's the steering committee. See, they probably have a problem with the steering committee because the department was so committed to try to do the right thing here that it appointed two deputy chiefs to co-chair the steering committee, and one of them is the newly appointed black deputy chief, Mario Arredondo, who is a longtime African American police officer and family is well respected and et cetera. And so I'm just trying to figure at what point the leadership can identify for some of us the many things that they've done.
That'd be very interesting, and I'm going to tell you the truth, Mr. Edwards. These people, you know, it's the new hustle, public safety. You know,
Yes, it is. And in fact, some have stood and we talked about it on this program. What was it, a month and a half ago? And no one has admonished us, if you will, when we read the our the proposal that, that was made. In fact, in the proposal is a demand from the governor for $10 million for just public safety alone.
Yes.
Yeah. To deal with the violence on the street and et cetera. You know what I mean? And I'm just trying to remember. Do you remember, Don, what happened to the faith-based patrol? Remember Faith Patrol?
Yeah, they've been on the street.
I remember they marched down the street one time, got a check for $85,000 or $90,000 from one of the foundations, probably was the Minneapolis Foundation, and we haven't heard from them since.
Oh, no, that was the move. That's the hustle. Show like you
okay.
Show like you're going to do it, get paid, and walk away.
Yeah. I just have to say in the situation with former Sergeant Alicia Clemons, I mean, I just have to be fair. For statements to be made to her that these gentlemen were the ones who made a difference here in Minneapolis, that's pretty insulting. You know, particularly when you know the history of the battle that Sergeant Clemons had to wage before she won $1 million settlement. I repeat that number again, $1 million settlement. And then, as I said before, phone lines are open now. You know, folks always talk about how they'll challenge us. When the Mill City Five, and let me name those officers, Hamilton, Edwards, no relationship, if you will, Arredondo, Harris, and Adams, when they won the $750,000 settlement, one of the things that they said to me, I congratulated them and et cetera, as they were coming out of the federal courthouse, and they talked about how disappointed they were that the leadership, the ministerial leadership at that time and others, the so-called African-American Forum and et cetera, where all our great leaders are, that those organizations never reached out to them. In fact, at one time, the Mill City Five, when they thought they were going to have to go to court, had asked some of our leaders if they would be prepared to testify to the character of African-American officers in this city, and they were turned down, man.
Oh, wow.
They were turned down, you know. And then yet I heard the new executive director of the African-American Forum talk in terms of bringing African-American law enforcement officers to the table to kind of get their mind right. That was about, remember we talked about that about 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago? Yeah. And I was like, wow, that's kind of bodacious, you know what I mean? So today down there, the NAACP leadership and the crime fighters indicated that they were demanding that they receive a place on these committees. And then, like I said, the chief of police said, what committees would you like to be on? And God dang me, Don, they couldn't identify a single committee.
They don't do their homework. They go down with lips greasy, Mr. Edwards. I mean, we've seen it so many times. That's why I stopped going to these community meetings. Because you can have 2 cents and give someone an idea, they'll run with it, get paid, and walk away. The community doesn't get help. The people in the community, you know, that are at different levels don't get any benefit. And these guys, you know, they go out, take their wives on a cruise, you know, buy a new Cadillac and some gold chains or whatever. But, you know, that doesn't surprise me at all in the least bit that no one did their homework before they went down and opened their mouth in front of the Department of Justice and Chief Harto. Okay?
Well, here's one of the things that also happened, and you know, because we know leaders are not going to talk about it. The chief and the department must have anticipated this move because, unbeknownst to the leaders before they arrived, the police department had released a press release. We have it in our file. And they identified, get this, man, they identified the stakeholders who had been invited to attend the meeting and to participate in the discussions, but who chose not to respond and not to be there. And I kind of am saying to you that a couple of the folks that performed down there today were on the list and never showed up. And I understand now, you know, maybe if I'm wrong, somebody call and correct me or, you know, get my man right, that the chief, after the, you know, the dog and pony show, the chief said, well, I'm really disappointed because you gentlemen, were asked to specifically participate and bring forward your ideas and et cetera, and you didn't respond. She said, I'm here every Tuesday. she sets aside an hour and a half to meet with community. She said, you gentlemen have never been here. You've never come.
Mm.
Now, that, you know, I wouldn't let nobody, you know, I wouldn't let nobody trap me like that, Don. You know what I'm saying, partner? I wouldn't let, you know, the chief, I mean, she come at them, I mean, cut them like she was cutting them with a razor blade. They didn't even know they was bleeding.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's
yeah.
Well, that's the community, Mr. Edwards. You know, this is not a surprise to you. That's why our community is in chaos. That's why we cannot. I was talking to, let me bring this up real quick. I was talking to someone that went to a meeting about a month ago where it was just white agencies from the State Department on down talking about splitting up about $500 million.
Ooh, okay.
And it was out in Chaska, or Chanhassen, excuse me, it was out in Chanhassen.
Chanhassen, yes. It's a nice retreat out there,
Yeah, and this gentleman was invited by another brother who works for a company that is based in Chicago but has an office here. So he's not really into the politics of the who's here. So he said, hey, why don't you just come out with me?
Okay.
So he went out there, and this gentleman reported back to me. He goes, Don, they was on stage talking about how they go divide, you know, $500 million, and then they go get another $300 or $400 million later in the year, and how to divide that amongst their agency. And
yeah.
there wasn't any of the North Side spokespersons there. There wasn't these people who came downtown and complained, or these folks that get on Facebook and act like they got a following of 10 million people and they only got 100 friends. And so. It's funny that you say that, but I mean, I'm not surprised, because I watched this happen. You watched this happen way longer than I have. These people can't put pen to paper or mind to thought to write on the piece of paper to even come up with an idea.
See, well, you're absolutely correct, sir, because when we vetted their proposal, I mean, I was shocked. And now, by the way, I understand that there's been an attempt to try to go back to the industrial park that William English indicates that he would be the prime majority owner of, if you will. And I guess that's not getting anywhere. In fact, you know, maybe we can get an update. I know there was a meeting Saturday at one of our churches there as they tried to discuss strategy. Maybe we could get an update on where they're at with the, is it 26 to 29? Because after we started talking about it, I know it went up another $3
million. Oh, it went up like around $30 million now, you know, and that part of that. But see, you could tell, Mr. Edwards, that these folks aren't getting the money, because part of this money was the hustle with the HVAC programs inside of some of these Minsky schools. And the governor put a kibosh on raising any funds for the Minsky schools this time around, or giving them any money. And
yes,
so
he
I
did.
Yeah, these people are scattering like roaches with the lights cut on to try to figure out, because I'm going to tell you, they're getting broke. I'm getting phone calls, Mr. Edwards, from real people, real community leaders that have full-time jobs, that folks is calling and asking them to borrow money. Some of these same people that was downtown today.
Yes. I can believe it. And also, layoffs have begun. Article this morning's paper, big headline. Layoffs have begun. Now, we have $1 billion surplus in the state of Minnesota, by the way, for our listening audience. A $1 billion surplus. That's pretty good management. But what has happened because of the failure of so many of our social welfare programs and et cetera, the Department of Human Services has already began layoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many will be? They started out with 43 or 42 on Friday, if you will. They maintain that the number is flexible for them. It could be another 35 or 40. It could be 200 or 300. And you're absolutely right. People are shocked because with $1 billion profit margin, if you will, or, you know, folks were expecting that happy days were here again. This governor has different thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he said was that a lot of that $1 billion is going to be directed towards education, because the latest figures came out, you and others, that in education would have an appreciation. You know, we're 33rd as it pertains to the graduation rate in the public schools. 33rd.
Yeah. Yeah, and see,
yeah,
and
we almost passed, man.
And the problem here, Mr. Edwards, is like there's this thing called the theory of constraints, putting first things first and removing each constraint one at a time.
One at a time. Thank you.
And the people here aren't seeing that because in the classroom, you have black children and you have white children in the same classrooms in North Minneapolis. The white children are graduating. If you look at the whole picture, there's a culture issue there that the teachers and, well, it's administration, basically, aren't bringing down into the school for the teachers to use, for them to deal with. And so
now, hold your point there, Mr. Allen, because that is exactly one of the things that they maintain that Principal Cruz, the woman that we talked about earlier, brought here from Chicago, given a 3-year contract to fresh start Green Central. She was saying exactly the same thing. She had already kind of done a diagnostic, if you will, on what was happening in her institution, and that's the reason she sent 43 Caucasian educators out of the door, you know. And the system said, no, you can't do that because we want to continue to miseducate the sons and daughters of the African. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's a heck of a point, sir, that you raise.
Mm-hmm.
Again, mm-hmm. The phone line is open, you know, for anybody that has any inquiry or question, you know. Folks do a lot of talking on their websites, don't they?
Oh, yeah. That Facebook, they blow up. You know, the Facebook WCCO. Oh, I'm sorry, WCCO. I like you now. I didn't mean to bring up your name. There's a Fox 9 on Facebook. I like WCCO now, so I got to leave. I got to stay off them for a minute because they came through for me a couple times here. But
okay.
Yeah, but you got, you know, you're looking at this dilemma here with these constraints that these children have. And, I mean, I've seen some of these teachers in the school, Mr. Edwards. I actually did a clinical at this school in St. Paul where they were bringing me the minority students that were cutting up. These are kindergartners. And all you have to do, a black teacher can look the brothers in the eye, okay? And they know, hey, you know, you need to just cool out and do what you're supposed to do.
Need to chill. But, need to chill. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But there wasn't no black people in that building but me. And so it was really funny. It was really funny because when the kids, I didn't have no problems with them at all whatsoever. They were actually super bright, super intelligent, just got the work done, understood what they had to do, and were creative as they want to be. But they got in front of these other teachers, and it was like these white teachers, and just kind of decided to shut down on them. And they're doing the best of what they had to work with, but in St. Paul and in Minneapolis, the teachers have some constraints with administration that just don't make you want to do a good job. Then you have the teachers from Rosemont, Minnesota, come in here, and from Apple Valley, and from way outside of the city that have never even seen a black child in a school setting. So they don't know what to do.
That's right. That's right. What is that? What's that program? Teach America or America Teach or whatever
Teach
they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in a session last summer that was being held at one of the community centers, and these little young girls, they put them on a little yellow school bus and brought them in from Medford, Minnesota, and a couple other places going towards the south. I mean, they were in a state of shock, man. You could see them looking around at all these little black children, and it was like, oh, my God, what? Look at the little savages, you know, the little pygmies, you know. I bet all of them are named LeBron James, huh? I mean, and no one wants to deal with that. That's why the chairman of the teachers board looked at you in such a strange, I mean, you know, you're not supposed to talk like that. Because the first thing they always like to say is that, gentlemen, you see race and black and white in every corner. You guys are paranoid. No, we're not. If you look at what's happening in this country, particularly in the area of education and economics, you know, I did a piece in the Spokesman Recorder for last week talking about the national championship game, Ohio State. And congratulations to the Buckeyes. You know, I'm happy for them. Makes them a richer university and et cetera. But I called it the Plantation Bowl. And one of the reasons was the kind of money, well, basically what it said, white profit, black poverty, okay? Because that's what's happening. At least in the pro game, they got to pay you some kind of salary. And, you know, what's basically happening, man, is that we are continuing to decline as it pertains to academic and intellectual attainment and achievement, and that's frightening. That's frightening because you hear people talking about, well, maybe the only role for them is to let them go fight wars.
Oh yeah.
And when you talk about the brutality, and you served your nation with distinction and honor, Mr. Allen, you know that war is not a game that you play on a video machine.
Oh,
not
no.
The real war. Okay. And I'm concerned of what I see happening and how it's happening. And by the way, on that particular note, I had made a commitment to an educator. I wonder how the selection process is going for the next superintendent of schools here in Minneapolis.
Yeah, well, I think
you haven't heard anything about that?
I haven't heard a thing. I think they're going to let that one drag out a minute. I'm kind of curious about that myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Because I would have thought that our NAACP and other Urban League and et cetera would have been right at the forefront of demanding, first of all, to be on the search committee and et cetera. I haven't heard anything, nothing at all. And I just don't think that a new African-American superintendent in Minneapolis is in the cards.
Unless R.T. Ryback come in.
You know, I find it fascinating. This is a man who is allegedly going to educate the little African-American child, yet he would do nothing to give their parents employment.
Mm-hmm.
Work. Oops. Yeah. You starve the parents, and then we're to be led to believe that you're going to help educate the children? I don't think so. I really don't. Well, Mr. Allen, we're beginning to come into the stretch. Anything else that's on the agenda that we have not touched on that we are still aware of?
Well, of course, I need to just talk about. Let me pull it up here so I can be on exacts. You know, I intercepted an email and was looking at some stuff, but we're having an issue with the. Senator Hayden, State Representative Rena Moran, and Senator Champion, and their support for the legislative agenda of the Council on Black Minnesotans. And so we learned this week, Mr. Edwards, that Senator Jeff Hayden has decided that he would push the Asian Council legislative agenda and will not touch or come near the Council on Black Minnesotans legislative agenda. So I can let that marinate for a minute, but that does say a lot about what they're not doing for based on their community. So what I did, Mr. Edwards, is I gave them a list of things to do in 2015 between now and October. And one of them was if 25 people in your state Senate district do not have gainful employment by October 2015, you must resign. That's North Minneapolis, South Minneapolis, St. Paul. If there's not a minimum of 100 new black or minority-owned business startups in your state, Senate districts that you officiate over, you must resign by October 2015. So I go on a list like four more, you know, kind of ultimatum type things, but
incredible
response. But, you know, if you're not going to support your own people, then why even be in office? Because that's what their platforms were. You know, we're going to support our African-American people and businesses and all this. They haven't really done it, from what I can see.
I don't see the flow. I don't see the escalation, if you will, the infusion. I look around me all the time trying to see black businesses, new black businesses, viable black businesses. I'm not seeing it, if you will. The statistical data we checked before program tonight the labor statistics indicate that we continue as African Americans to be at the bottom of the totem pole as it pertains to employment. Definitely we know where we're at in education. We just cited it a couple minutes ago. The figure allegedly now, only 53% of African Americans who started the Minneapolis public schools, only 53% graduate. So that means 47% just kind of go into the wilderness. You know what I'm saying? And when you see those kinds of reversals, negative reversals, then, you know, then you have to really seriously begin to talk about the future of African-American young people in this city and in this state. And I say it like this, Mr. Allen. I don't know where is the plan for our economic recovery. I'll say it like that. Mm-hmm. Where is the plan for our economic recovery as the African-American community?
There is not.
And by the way, there's going to be an interesting meeting at OIC Thursday night talking about the utilization of Lucy Laney as some kind of experimental laboratory.
Ooh. Yeah, people check that out. We're going to come and check that out. That's pretty serious.
Yeah. Well, all right, Mr. Allen, you know, we've done what we could, move the agenda. Hey, to our good friend, Reverend Gil Ford out there in Baltimore, baby, you know, stay tuned.
Yeah.
And on the serious note, the best of success in Cincinnati and Duluth, if you will. And by the way, we haven't forgotten our friends, the African Americans community under siege in Albert Lea, Minnesota. It's wild down there, man. No, but nobody will step up for them. Feel bad for the black folk down there, man. Police treating them like 12 years of slave.
Not good at all.
All right, let James Brown take us home, Donald Allen. Let him take us home.
Take a seat, okay?
Make a pound.